Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend and neighbor, Klaus Laris, is a professor of history. He also teaches in the Peace, War, and Defense curriculum over at Carolina. He is an expert on recent European history, politics, policy. And in a recent talk, he talked about, this is the title of the talk, Churchill, the United States, and Peace Negotiations, Lessons for the 21st Century. All that's part of a series that he manages and recruits wonderful speakers under the program, the U.S. in World Affairs, the Cold War, and Beyond. This is a lecture series, Klaus, that you've organized and promoted, recruited, funded, and...
That's very true. Well, not funded myself, luckily, but we always need a good audience, so please come and join us.
Yeah, talk a little bit, for those who have not had the wonderful benefit of going to your I won't call it your lectureship, because you've got lots of partners in it, but it's generally in the Wilson Library.
That's right. It takes place in the Family Pleasance Room in the Wilson Library, usually 5, 6, 7 talks each semester. And as the title of the series says, it deals with America's role in the world. So we often have talks on U.S.-Russian relations, U.S.-European relations, what the U.S. Thinks about China and Asia and other topics, you know, global topics. And we have a wide variety of speakers, usually eminent scholars, often from Washington, D.C. or other universities in the country. And the mix of talks and the mix of speakers, I think, is the interesting dimension of the series. Students come along, faculty comes along, and increasingly we have a very active membership from the general community here in the Triangle area. And people, young and old, are very welcome to come along. It usually takes place at 5:30 p.m. on a Tuesday or Thursday. And, you know, if you write to me, send me an email, I'll put you on my mailing list and you will be inundated with future announcements.
Well, the one thing that still, although we've been told that the parking regulations may change, that now after 5 o'clock, you can park.
Absolutely.
Find a parking place.
Yeah, after 5 p.m., that is the reason why the lectures begin at 5:30 p.m., but after 5 p.m., you can park for free at UNC, and I always recommend to people to go to Cobb Deck, which is only 5-6 minutes away on foot from the Wilson Library. That's the most convenient one. But you can park anywhere else after 5 p.m. It's free, and it's much easier than before 5 p.m.
It's very convenient, and for those people who live in Chapel Hill and don't get enough of a touch of the campus because of the parking situation. That's, after 5 o'clock is a good time to come, and this is great. You want to give your email address? It's pretty easy to remember.
Yeah, it's my surname, my last name, Laris at unc.edu, and Laris is spelled L-A-R-R-E-S.
Great. Well, you've given a talk recently about Churchill and the lessons. I guess Churchill is a diplomat during the Cold War, or in his diplomatic efforts during the 20th century. What lessons are there?
Normally, I don't talk myself in the lecture series, but I thought once in a while I should give a talk myself so that people actually see I can actually give a paper
myself.
You can
myself. Do something other than
exactly,
introduce the speakers.
And not just moderate and introduce the speakers.
Well, I should say this. I should have said this, but you've written a book on Churchill.
Churchill's Cold War, which came out a number of years ago, and it's, of course, a brilliant read. I can recommend it to anyone. I'm just joking. But Churchill is the most fascinating statesman, of course. He spends the end of the 19th century and the largest part of the 20th century. He was involved in all major diplomatic enterprises of the 20th century, starting with the colonial wars Britain fought in Sudan, in South Africa, in India, in the 1880s and 1890s, where Churchill was involved as a young soldier, as a war correspondent partially when he was in his 20s. And then, of course, he rose quickly into politics. He first entered the House of Commons, the British Parliament, in 1890. And then he quickly eventually rose to cabinet level, and he was a cabinet minister during the First World War. And we all know that he got sacked and fired because of the Gallipoli invasion, which he designed. It was his mental product, and it went, of course, terribly wrong, and he had to take the blame for that. And after that, he was briefly out of office, but then when his friend David Lloyd George became prime minister in 1917, in the middle of the First World War, or Churchill was called back in 1917, I should say, rather, and he again became a cabinet minister very quickly. Then he lost power again in the 1920s. He had various posts before that. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer, as his father had been before him briefly, and he held other cabinet posts. But then in the 1920s...
What was his political party?
It was originally the Conservative Party, but then he crossed the floor and went to the Liberal Party. And of course, he has always been accused that he's not reliable, that he changes his party as he changes his shirt, and that he was an opportunist. And one cannot deny that. Churchill had always an eye for success, for being in the limelight. And when the power of the Conservative Party was waning and he saw a chance to remain in office as a member of the Liberal Party, he did so, and he crossed the floor, as they say in Britain. But of course, also his political views at that time were closer to the Liberal Party. Churchill has a radical, conservative radical reputation, but initially, at least, he was socially a progressive. He was, together with David Lloyd George, before he became Prime Minister, they were close friends in the House of Commons. They were seen as progressive politicians who pushed for the introduction of a welfare state, how we would call it today. They were in favor of social legislation, and that gave them a radical reputation. And that, of course, made him closer to the Liberal Party than to that quite overaged, old, encrusted Conservative Party at the time.
You haven't said anything about his diplomatic efforts.
No, at that stage, you know, after the First World War, when he was out of power, and also before the First World War, he focused to a large extent on home affairs. And of course, when it went wrong with the First World War, though he was influential during the First World War, he was a cabinet minister for munitions. He was First Lord of the Admiralty and in charge of Britain's powerful navy.
I think you told me in your book, Klaus, that he had made a fumbling effort before the
Absolutely.
First World War to try to
yes.
keep the peace.
What I argue in the book, and what I will also argue in my talk, is that Churchill was always in favor of great power diplomacy in a very traditional way. He believed the great powers, the great statesmen of the age, and at that time it was Britain, it was Russia, it was Germany, and up-and-coming United States, should get together to resolve world crisis. So by talking around the table, by negotiating very informally in very small circles, he believed the important crisis of his age could be resolved. And before the First World War, the great powers of the day were Britain and the rising Germany. And Germany had just been united in 1871. It was seen as an aggressive power, a power which wanted to obtain its place in the sun, which had been denied to it for so long. It wanted colonies and demanded colonies, and it also wanted to compete with Britain on the high seas. The British, of course, had the most powerful navy at the time, and the Germans were busily building a powerful navy themselves. So they were quickly catching up with the British. And that led to tension. If you want to compare it to today, you would say we have the United States, the superpower of the day, and there is that up-and-coming great power, China. And China is competing with the United States and wants its probably rightful place in the sun as well. The existing superpower, the United States, isn't too keen on having or being challenged that way. They, of course, want to remain at the top alone. And that was the same with Britain before the First World War, when Germany tried to dispute Britain's great power role. The British were not too impressed.
Well, so what did this young whippersnapper still, Churchill, think he could do in terms of negotiating with the Germans to try to hold them back, I guess, from their aspirations of being...
Yeah, he believed, and in a way, he, of course, totally overestimated his own importance, his own power. He was First Lord of the Admiralty, so in charge of Britain's navy, and he believed if he himself got together with the German Admiral Tirpitz, who was in charge of Germany's navy, if they had bilateral talks and negotiations, they could resolve the Anglo-German naval race. And he suggested that to Foreign Minister Grey and to the Prime Minister. And these very senior, very experienced, much older politicians were not too impressed. They didn't say no immediately, but said, well, let's wait what the Germans have got to say about that. And Tirpitz made some indications that he might be interested in a talk around the table with Churchill. But a proper suggestion, a proper proposal for such talks never arrived from Berlin. And when Grey and the Prime Minister waited for a little while and Churchill kept pushing for the negotiations, but when nothing materialized from Berlin, they basically said, come on, you know, forget about it. We can't do anything about it. But it's indicative of, and Churchill had to, you know, he pushed for it for a little while. He was quite persistent, but in the end, he couldn't do much and had to really bury his proposal. But it's indicative of his, first, of course, of his persistence and of his belief in himself that he could do that as a young politician who really didn't have the most senior position in Britain at all. And thirdly, that he believed in his personal ability to negotiate bilaterally and obtain success. And
it reminds me of a current American politician. Was there a little bit of Trump to Donald Trump and Winston Churchill's belief in him?
I tell you what, you
do not want to answer that question. We're going to take a break. we're visiting with Klaus Laris about his recent talk about Churchill and foreign policy, Cold War, and lessons for today. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor Klaus Laris, and we're talking about his recent talk about Winston Churchill. And Winston Churchill, his experience in diplomacy and dealing with in the Cold War, and what lessons there might be for us. Klaus, we talked about a little bit of the basics about Winston Churchill. Bring us into the time that you think is more significant in terms of his experience and lessons learned.
Yeah, what I wanted to say was really that Churchill was A, very convinced of his own powers of persuasion, and secondly, he believed that you could achieve diplomatic and political results by negotiations, by talks. During the Second World War, he once called it "Georgia is better than war," and that is what he really meant. And of course, he also wanted to negotiate in a very small, informal way. When we look at the current circus of multilateral negotiations and get-togethers and summits, then politicians of the world always arrive with at least 100 advisors and other people, aides in as entourage. That is not what Churchill had in mind. He really wanted to show up by himself, maybe an interpreter on top of that, and that was it. And that, of course, was anathema to the people in the British Foreign Office or in the American State Department. These people were the experts on certain topics, economic topics, monetary topics, war strategy topics. How could one man, someone like Churchill or Roosevelt, believe they could do it all by themselves? But Churchill's style was in that way very old-fashioned and very much believing in his own powers of persuasion. And during the Second World War, that sort of negotiation tactics was confirmed. The big three conferences at Tehran, at Yalta, at Potsdam, that of course was really the get-together of Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill, and important decisions were taken. Of course, there were aides. There were not just these guys by themselves, but compared to the circus of international negotiations which is going on today, it was a relatively limited circle of advisors. And that confirmed Churchill in his view that that was the right way to approach things.
Were there any successes in that in the Second World War negotiations that gave Churchill a good reason to believe that he his way of doing things was the best way?
Depends on your point of view. From the American and the Soviet point of view, there were successes. From the British point of view, we know that the British, after Stalingrad, after early 1943, were losing in power and influence. Then the Soviet Union, the Red Army, was all-powerful. They drove the German Nazi forces further and further to the west. Then the United States came in with an ever-increasing army, and the British were really the very small junior partner, and they increasingly noticed that. And Churchill actually said at Tehran in November 1943 that he was sitting in the middle with the big Russian bear and the big American buffalo, and here there was a small English donkey, but the small English donkey was the only one who knew the right way home. So his view was he didn't have the power and the resources, but the British had the brains for working out a war strategy.
Well, this was in the middle of the war where these allies are coming together. This is really not about peace. This is about how are we going to conduct a military
yes.
operation. So it's not exactly
no, that's
the kind
right.
of conversations that you have when you got
no,
immediately different objectives and points of
no,
view.
No, and that but it that way of negotiation confirmed Churchill in Churchill's mind that that was the right way to conduct things. When he came to office again after the Second World War, during
just
the Cold War.
Just for those of us
yeah.
who weren't alive following this after, most people who follow these things remember that Churchill, after achieving the victory in Europe or being a part of that, was immediately voted out of office and was not active officially. So What did he do during this time, and when did he get back into the negotiation?
Yeah, he was chucked, as you rightly said, he was chucked out by the British electorate in August 1945. He became leader of His Majesty's opposition, so he was still in charge of the Conservative Party. He had rejoined the party in earlier in the 1930s. And so he was in charge of the opposition, but he never fancied being a leader of opposition. He saw himself as a grand statesman. And he was also highly depressed after losing the election. So he went to the south of France, enjoyed the wine and the sun, and started writing his war
was
memoirs.
Depressed clinically or
yes,
just
yes.
very sad?
He was sad
course,
and disappointed,
yeah.
but it is, has also been proven that he was fighting with bouts of depression. He himself called it his black dog. And ever so often, and often without proper reasons, it affected him. And he had, throughout his life, and particularly when he, during the Second World War and later, he had to deal with serious bouts of depression. They often lasted for weeks, and then he came out of it often quite vigorously. I don't think he, at least I don't know, I haven't heard about it, I don't think he used real professional help. That probably was also not the done thing in the 1940s and 1950s in Britain, but he clearly suffered from depression.
During that time when he was out of office, were there diplomatic efforts that he tried to get involved in, even as a member of the opposition?
Well, we all know the Iron Curtain speech of March 1946.
Well, no, we don't all know that now. remind us about this Fulton, Missouri speech.
Yes. Well, as I said, when Churchill was out was out of office but leader of the opposition, he did not really deal with the mundane British politics in the House of Commons. He believed he was a world statesman, and he wasn't wrong. And in 1946, President Truman, U.S. President Truman, asked him to travel to Missouri, in Fulton, Missouri. There was a little college town, and Truman, of course, was from Missouri. So he asked Churchill to give a speech. And for Truman, that speech was a balloon effort, a test to check out whether the American public was already sufficiently anti-Soviet so that he himself could pursue a slightly more anti-Soviet policy than hitherto. But the American public wasn't really ready, because what they remembered was the Uncle Joe, Stalin of the wartime, the ally of the Second World War, who had helped quite decisively to defeat Hitler. So by 1946, that rising Cold War tension was well known among foreign policy elites and the establishment, but not really among the wider public. So Truman asked Churchill to give a speech which was seen as quite anti-Soviet, talking about the Iron Curtain descending between East and West in order to test the water. And initially, that speech actually was highly unpopular. It took quite a few months before public opinion came round and appreciated that speech. But when you dig deeper into that speech, it was partially anti-communist, anti-Soviet. But in the middle of the speech, Churchill also says that one should look for a settlement with the Soviet Union. He did. It wasn't just a call to arms. It was also the suggestion to talk and negotiate with the Soviet Union to settle things amicably. There was tension. There was something needed to be done. There was a fear of a nuclear world war if things continued. But there was a chance to get round the table and talk and negotiate. And that was actually Churchill's grand theme of both his opposition years and then his second premiership when he was voted back into office in 1951. For him, what was the most important theme of the time was to overcome the Cold War and to settle things with the Soviet Union amicably. That also, that had, of course, a global dimension, a peace and war dimension. It also had a very personal dimension. Churchill realized that he would go down in history as that war premier, the prime minister who had won the war for Britain. But he also wanted to go down in history as a peacemaker. He did not want to have an aggressive reputation. And so there was some personal dimension to it. On top of that, Churchill was getting kind of old. And he realized that he needed a good theme to prolong his time in active politics, his career.
Let's take a quick break and come back to Churchill back in office in the early 50s.
Sure.
I'm visiting with Klaus Lawrence. We're talking about Winston Churchill, the lessons from his efforts at diplomacy for today. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor Klaus Lawrence. We're talking about a speech that he gave recently about Winston Churchill, about diplomacy, about the experiences in the Cold War, and what lessons we can learn from them. When we took a break, we were following Churchill's career post-war when he was out of office, and now you're about to bring him back in office and tell us what he did when he had power to.
Yeah. Yes. As I said, even during the years when he was leader of the opposition, his grand theme gradually seemed to be to overcome the emerging Cold War with the Soviet Union by calling for negotiations, for talks with Stalin.
Can I interrupt you just because today, whenever we talk about negotiations or about making peace with our adversaries, we're reminded of the Neville Chamberlain negotiations with Hitler and where that led, and that Winston Churchill is viewed as the one who was skeptical about the negotiations.
Absolutely.
and the counter to it, so that when we talk about whatever peacemaking we might do, the United States might do in terms of giving things up to our adversaries, it's always, this is Munich all over again, and what we need is a Churchill who will stand up to the bad guys.
Yes, that is a slightly misguided view. That is a very one-sided view. While it is true that in the 1930s, Churchill was one of the few who called for opposing Hitler, for rearming. After the Second World War, he believed that the West was actually quite strong. There was no need to rearm vigorously because the Soviet Union had been utterly destroyed during the Second World War. The Western powers, led by the United States, was actually very, very strong. And above all, the only power in possession of the nuclear bomb was the United States. And that gave the Western world, particularly the United States, an advantage, a window of opportunity, because it would be a few years before the Soviet Union had caught up. And he called on the United States to exploit that opportunity, not by dropping a bomb on the Soviet Union, but by using that position of strength to try to negotiate the Soviets and to make sure that they would that the Cold War could be overcome, the tension of the Cold War. There was another dimension to that, and that was that Churchill, though having an American mother, being half American, being always pro-American, having founded the special relationship, deep down he didn't quite trust the United States. He, during the Second World War, he was a close friend of Franklin Roosevelt, but he also had his suspicions about Franklin Roosevelt. And that continued after the Second World War. So he was a friend of the United States, but he also was, of course, closer to his own country. And he believed that American politicians often were kind of rash and rushed into war and into aggressive position much too quickly. So he feared that by some silly accident, by some misunderstood problem on the world stage, the United States would actually use the atomic bomb prematurely and then unleash a third world war and the end of civilization would come close. And therefore he believed the United States also needed to be guided carefully into negotiations with the Soviet Union, of course under his personal leadership.
Those of us who've read just the regular histories of this period would believe that Churchill's primary concern during this time was to resist the pressure that he was feeling both from the United States and I assume also from the Soviets to decolonize and to get rid of their colonies. Was this really an important factor for him, and how did it fit in with the other negotiations?
Yes, it was really something separate. He, Roosevelt, by means of the Atlantic Charter, for example, of 1940, had put pressure on the British, on Churchill, to grant independence to their colonies, to give up the empire, essentially, after the Second World War. And there was pressure on the British to do so, not just from the Americans, also the rising nationalism in almost all colonies, particularly India, for example, was almost irresistible. And the British promised to India that in return for providing troops and aid during the Second World War, they would be granted independence. And that happened under the Labour government shortly after the Second World War. Churchill was always opposed to that. He was an arch-imperialist. He believed in the greatness of the British Empire, and he continued to believe in that when it was really already very unrealistic. That was independent from his belief you had to negotiate with the Soviet Union. But you see, that was another area of confrontation, area of dispute at least with the United States. Despite his belief that India shouldn't be granted independence, he also knew that he needed the United States to provide security for Europe, to provide the nuclear umbrella, and that he needed the political influence of the United States to negotiate with the Soviets. And that is what his main theme of his second premiership, his peacetime premiership, became. Let me briefly add, there was another theme, particularly during the opposition years, which he proclaimed, and that was the establishment, the creation of a united Europe. He gave famous speeches in Zurich and The Hague and Strasbourg calling for the United States of Europe. And he said, and I'm glad the United States is actually on my side. Washington also likes to create a United States of Europe. So he was very much in favor to work towards an integrated Europe. What people overlooked at the time, there was great applause for that. What people overlooked at the time was that Churchill didn't mean that Britain was part of it. He meant it a united Europe for the continental Europeans, excluding Britain, not including Britain. Because his empire understanding of Britain's role in the world could never foresee that Britain should actually be part of an integrated Europe. And also, he wasn't as deeply involved in that idea about a united Europe than he was involved in overcoming the Cold War. As soon as he got to office again in 1951, he pursued the negotiation
topic with the Soviet Union. He totally forgot about the European integration topic. He lost all interest and he didn't pursue it at all. Neither the Labour government of 1945 nor the Churchill government of 1951 wanted to become a part of the Schuman Plan of the early 1950s, which was the forerunner of the European Economic Community. None of them wanted to hear anything about it. So in that respect, Churchill was not visionary. He basically underestimated, as almost all British politicians did, the later meaning of the common market, as it was called in Britain.
Well, during this time, as he came back into office, Konrad Adenauer and his successors were pulling Germany, or the western side of Germany, together, and also beginning a confrontation right there on the border between East and West Germany. What were Churchill's views, and how did he seek to participate?
Well, Adenauer would not say that he began a confrontation. Adenauer would have said the East began the confrontation.
Of course, a confrontation developed.
No, that was part of the Cold War, and Churchill believed that division of Germany was unhealthy. He believed that the Germans were revisionist or would be revisionist in a few years' time, and that they would try to unite. That would be dangerous. That would be maybe lead to military action. So that was one of his motivating forces.
Well, now, I'm not sure I understand. Yeah. Churchill favored the continued division of Germany.
Not at all. Not at all. The division of Germany occurred for good in 1949, when the two German states were set up. It was driven by the Western powers, who believed that it is better to be in charge of a West German democracy than to have a united Germany where the Soviet Union has a strong influence. So Stalin always was in favor of a united Germany, because a united Germany would give him a higher level of influence. If there was a separate democratic West Germany, Stalin had no influence over that country, the largest and richest part of Germany, only over East Germany, which was largely agricultural and much poorer. And that disappointed Stalin. Churchill initially went along with Western policy of the division of Germany and welcomed it. But in due course, he realized that the division of Germany contributed significantly to Cold War tension between East and West. And he wanted to overcome that tension. Secondly, he believed that the West Germans and the East Germans would not put up forever with having a divided country. So at some stage, they might resort to military action to bring about the unification of their country. And that was his deep belief in the forces of German nationalism. And in order to prevent that, he believed the Cold War needed to be overcome. And as long as Stalin was in power, negotiating with that ever more paranoid, ruthless dictator seemed to be really make no point. He tried it once or twice, but there was not much came back from the Soviet Union.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back to what happened after Stalin died.
Okay.
We're visiting with Klaus Lauritz. We're talking about Winston Churchill as a diplomat and in the Cold War, and hopefully lessons that we might apply to today. Dr. Lauritz and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Klaus Lauritz, a professor at the University of North Carolina, about a wonderful talk he gave recently about Churchill, about diplomacy, and about the lessons to be learned from Churchill's experience. And Klaus, we've got just a few minutes, and we got lots more to talk about, but bring it home.
A certain turning point in the early Cold War occurred with Stalin's death in March 1953. His successors, these were various people, a number of people, they seemed to be more open to better relations with the West. That is at least how Churchill saw it. American President Eisenhower and German Chancellor Adenauer, West German Chancellor Adenauer, were much more skeptical. But Churchill then proposed two initiatives in 1953 and in 1954, a year later. And he wanted to start negotiations with the Soviet Union. And of course, he wanted to get the participation of the United States. And that did not happen because the United States and also West German Chancellor Adenauer were dead set against it. They believed you can't negotiate with these guys. You first have to solidify the West, to strengthen the West, to create NATO, maybe include West Germany into NATO to get a real position of strength. And perhaps then you negotiate. Churchill believed then it's too late. You have to do it now while everything is still fluid. Once you have proper Cold War settlement, then you know negotiations are not possible anymore. And in 1953, he failed, and not least because there was the uprising in East Germany, which seemed to be a bad opportunity to then start negotiations with the East. He also had a stroke himself, so he was bedridden for a few months. So he tried again in 1954. Again, the United States didn't want to hear about it. So Churchill sent a telegram by himself to Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov, said, "Please invite me to Moscow. I wish to embark on a solitary pilgrimage to Moscow to talk things over." And the Soviet Union never did. And the question is, why did the Soviet Union not exploit that opportunity, also the opportunity to drive a wedge into the Western alliance? And the answer can only be the Soviet Union was too skeptical of Churchill. Churchill's Cold Warrior image and profile, they believed full-heartedly. They did not trust that Churchill was actually really interested in overcoming the Cold War.
Do we know that from seeing the Soviet papers?
Yes, you see that from Soviet documents and from what Soviet diplomats told us and wrote in their papers, which we have seen in the meantime. If it had been someone else than Churchill, if it had been the Americans, I think the chances would have been much higher. Churchill was so distrusted by the Soviets. He was also the guy who in 1917 condemned the Bolshevik Revolution, talked about Bolshevism as the pestilence of the world and things like that. And he had not wanted to open the Second Front in the Second World War. So there was so much suspicion against Churchill that suddenly they did not believe he was now a peacemaker. And that then really brought his initiatives to an end. And in April 55, he resigned.
What are the lessons?
The lessons are clearly that, and I think we have seen these lessons today, recently with the Iran negotiations, that you have to be persistent with negotiations. You should not easily embark on aggressive action. You should really continue negotiations, even if it's difficult, even if it needs many years to do that. And even, I may add, Reagan's foreign minister, George Shultz, at the end of the Cold War, when Reagan was talking to Gorbachev, which of course were quite successful negotiations, Shultz quoted Churchill's 1953 speech and really positively and said, "We have to try to negotiate. You know, it is better to negotiate than go to war or have that sort of very Cold War tension with us, which may lead ultimately to nuclear war." And if Shultz, Reagan's, you know, conservative Secretary of State, quotes Churchill, that means Churchill really was accepted by the American establishment, which condemned him in 1953 and 1954.
Well, we've had these negotiations with one adversary, Iran, and depending on your viewpoint about it, it's a great success or a great, you know, mistake. But our other, to me, more troublesome relationship is with the reconstituted successor to the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. No.
What are the lessons?
Russia is another good example. And we have a dividing attitude among the West, the United States, not so much the White House, but a lot of people in Congress would like much firmer action, maybe even send troops to Ukraine, certainly rearm the Ukrainian army, while the Europeans, the Germans, the British, the French, are much more inclined to negotiate with the Russians and with Putin and impose sanctions and talk to him, but they're not dreaming of actually using military means to resolve the crisis. And I think Churchill would have agreed with the latter.
Definitely. And we talked earlier, and those who joined us late might not have heard that, but that the in this context of discussing with this low-level mini-dictator Putin, we say, negotiating with him about which would lead to affirming his illegal acts in annexing would be like would be all the Chamberlain and Munich all over again, and Churchill would say no, no, no to that.
No, yes, I agree. Churchill would not. You know, Russia has been much weakened. They have economic difficulties. The sanctions are biting. Global influence of Russia has been much decreased since the annexation of Crimea and the semi-invasion of Ukraine by Russian forces. Putin actually is not the statesman he would like to be. He has not increased the importance of Russia and his own personal importance, but has actually damaged his country. And I think in due course, probably it will take another few years, we will see a Russian turn around and the turning point in Russian-Western relations without war.
And should we continue to talk to them
absolutely
about things, even though we see no...
Absolutely. And also we have to see that Russia was heavily involved in the Iran negotiations, and America and Russia got on very well during the Iran negotiations. And that is, of course, a positive sign that they can work together on some aspects while disagreeing quite profoundly on others.
The topic for another program, because
absolutely.
This was wonderful. Thanks for
no, thank
us.
You for having me.
Churchill's a great hero for many of us here, and it's interesting to get your view based on scholarship that is very important. And
thank you very much.
Thanks to Klaus Lauris. Thanks to him for his recent talk, for the series of talks that he's organized, and for sharing with us today his views about lessons to learn from Churchill's experience as a diplomat. And thanks to you for listening. It's D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.